all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Nick Bradley. Nick is an Air Force veteran, has quite a story that we want to get out to our veteran radio listeners. Nick, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thanks for having me, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Well, we certainly want to talk about your military experiences, some of the hardships that and the struggles that came out of that, but also the lessons you've learned and things that has sort of surprised you over the last decade or 10 years or so. But let's start with this. You joined the United States Air Force in 2001. Why the Air Force? Why at that time?
So it's kind of a funny story, actually. So the night I graduated high school, my dad set me down and, you know, we were just kind of weighing out some of my options, you know, what the future held for me. And he essentially told me, son, I love you, but you have 30 days to get out of my house. And so, you know, when you put it in perspective like that, I mean, you got to figure out what you want to do real fast. And, you know, for an 18-year-old kid, that was a little scary. And I had been meeting with a Marine Corps recruiter, and my best friend had already left for boot camp. And he sends me a letter and he's like, Nick, don't join the Marines, join the Air Force. I hear it's way better. And so it's kind of funny how it all worked out, because he's still active duty Marines. But that day, after I got his letter, I went over and I talked to the Air Force recruiter and decided I really liked what he said. And the rest was kind of history. I signed up that day. It was June 25th, 2001, when I enlisted in the United States Air Force.
And you had obviously some additional training over the next couple of years. You were stationed in, I think, at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. What was your MOS? What were you being trained up for?
So I was security forces operator. My primary role, they do security and law enforcement. It's kind of like an MP, if you will, but the way the Air Force does it, it's a little different than the other branches, because the security forces, it's three or four different MOSs combined into one. So that's kind of where I jumped in. Now, what really helped me out at the time, a lot of guys were enlisting for 6 years. Well, I only enlisted for four, so I came in with no stripes. I'm what they call the slick sleeve. So I had, you know, it took me a while to put all those stripes on. So by the time I caught up to everybody, my resume at that point was extremely extensive, which afforded me a lot of opportunities to go to like a lot of specialized trainings and things of that nature. For instance, I went out to Nellis Air Force Base and flew drones. I got certifications to do that and, you know, things of that nature. So I got to do some kind of cool odds and ends outside of the scope of the normal MOS.
So naturally, anybody at that point in time who's been in for some couple of years, 3 or 4 years, you finally find yourself with some orders for deploying overseas. Tell us about your first deployment.
So my first tour overseas, it was in 2003. So it was at the end of 2003. So the war had kicked off earlier in 2003. And so I was going at the end, and we were originally slotted for Kuwait. We got there and we got forwarded a couple weeks in. So we were doing detainee operations out of Camp Buka, which is South Iraq. So we were essentially, we just do what we called flyaway missions, and we'd fly out, you know, pick up some bad guys, bring them back, process them through, and then fly home for the day.
Now, as you said, you only joined up for 4 years, so 2005 rolls around, and it's, you know, time for you to either re-enlist or get out. What was your thinking?
Well, you know, kind of just weighing the options. I really enjoyed what I was doing. I really, you know, more than that, I loved the people that I was working with. And, you know, I was just at a good spot in life, and I didn't really want to mess that up, so to speak. You know, I didn't want to cause any waves, really. And, you know, and I did. I had a passion to be in and serve, and I love putting that uniform on every day. So it really, it wasn't too strenuous for me to say, hey, I'm going to raise my right hand and do it all again. At that point, I had made my mind up. I was going to do 20 years. I was going to be a lifer. So
it
was
you,
a pretty easy decision.
Well, and that's great. You realist, and they say, well, we've got just the nice garden spot to send you off to. Where do they send you in 2005?
So in 2005, I actually got orders. I was attached to the Army's 3rd Infantry Division out of Balad, Iraq, which was about 40 minutes north of Baghdad. And from there, I was attached to the Army's 3rd Infantry Division, and I was sent over primarily to fly drones for them. Essentially what I would do is I would go out and I would fly the routes that the convoys were going to be running that evening. I would go ahead and fly the route just to make any notes. Hey, there's, you know, this route's obstructed with this vehicle, or keep an eye out for this, things of that nature, you know, just trying to give our guys the best advantage we could. And I mean, that was my primary job. Now, if I wasn't flying for them, since I was the lone Air Force guy there, I would usually end up in the turret of the Humvee on a raid or on a convoy, which wasn't the most desired position in the convoy, but it builds character, they say.
Those Army guys know you can't shoot straight in the Air Force. I can't even believe they'd let you do that.
Well, you know, it's funny. Well, I'm a country boy from Arkansas, so I grew up shooting my whole life. So I think that might have been part of it, is they knew that and took full advantage.
Well, you actually had a pretty high tempo in Iraq in 2005 on the number of surveillance missions that you flew for the convoys. Can you give us some sense of that tempo?
So it was a very high ops tempo. 2005 was a little chaotic in Iraq. At the time we were there, we were averaging, you know, 6+ mortar attacks on the base a day. I mean, it was super, super high ops tempo. Now, you know, we had a little team there, and I mean, I was running 24 hours a day, depending on when convoys were going out, when missions were launching, things of that nature, because I always had to run the routes for them. And sometimes I would fly the drone with them. Let's say I'm not in the convoy, I would actually fly the drone and it'd be above head as they're driving the route. So I would have direct comms with, you know, the truck commanders and all parties actually involved in the convoy. So it was super high ops. So I think if I'm not mistaken, it was 188 sorties.
Yeah, that helps people who may be listening to Veterans Radio who don't have a sense of just sort of what the tempo is. And we're talking to Staff Sergeant Nick Bradley, a good old boy from Arkansas, as he explains himself as, who re-enlisted and they sent him off to Iraq. But that wasn't, you know, okay, that's fine. You got through that. You come back and do some more training in the U.S., and then you get the call to go off to Afghanistan. Tell us about that tour.
Right. So it was March 1st at 12 o'clock noon, and one of the senior NCOs showed up and they told me to pack my bags. In 7 days, I was shipping out to Afghanistan. So real short notice there. Typically you get a month or two to kind of out process and say your goodbyes and things of that nature. And I had a week to do it. So it was a little stressful just from the beginning. But what we were doing over there, we were sent over, it was a special duty. We were part of a protective service detail. We called us PSD is what it was. And we were part of a Bravo team. and we were sent over to guard an Army general. We were part of his security detail. So wherever he went, we would clear the routes. We'd send out advance teams. You know, essentially they'd go out, you know, an hour ahead of time just to make sure everything was set up for him. And they'd take out the bomb dogs and, you know, just kind of secure the scene where we were going to be at. And that was my primary role in Afghanistan.
And Nick, would this include clearing those routes again, flying drones over, to running convoys to make sure they're clear, sort of the whole gambit of what it takes to clear a route?
Right. I mean, it is. It's everything encompassed in it. It's, I mean, you're flying drones. You're getting the bird's eye view of everything. Then you also, you've got to have the boots on the ground to really just, you know, see everything that's going on with a little bit better perspective. And so for instance, we send out an advance team. It's always an hour before the boss or the general would move. And so we'd run out, you know, say he's going to visit the president of Afghanistan. At the time it was Karzai. So we, you know, we're going over to his palace. So we're checking with the gate guards just to make sure they know to open the gates. Don't stop them. Don't hold them up. Because you don't ever want to have a sit and duck situation.
And this this goes on for four months or so until August 3rd of 2008, when you were on a protective service mission. And at that point, the vehicle that you're in is struck by a 20-pound anti-tank mine IED. Again, a normal protective security detail that morning until it wasn't, right?
Correct. It was just a normal day. We went out, turned off on this dirt road, and they called out, there was a culvert ahead, it's a perfect spot for an ID, we need to pick up pace. About that time, there was 100 meters away, there was two members of the Taliban that remotely detonated a 20-pound anti-tank mine. It hit right underneath the gear shift of the vehicle I was operating. I was driving a Toyota Land Cruiser, so just your standard SUV. Because when you're doing a protective service detail, you want to blend in with the local populace, or at least that's what the general wanted. So we weren't in a Humvee, or we weren't in any type of military vehicle with armor. But the explosion ripped up under the gear shift of the truck. It crushed every bone in my face, every bone in my right arm and hand. My right hip was fractured. My knee was crushed. My right shin was fractured, and my right foot was crushed as well. But I stayed in the vehicle through the explosion. Once the vehicle came to rest, it came to rest on the culvert actually. And then I fell out of the vehicle face first, 9 feet straight down into the culvert. Now what's to really just make matters more exciting, if you will, when you're doing a protective service detail, it's not like when I was in Iraq and, you know, if you receive fire from the enemy, you get to get out of your vehicle, you get to return fire, you can engage the enemy. Whereas when we're doing a protective service detail, that's not what you do. You're not a get out and fight force. So my team actually had to get the general back to the base, right? Get him to safety. And that's when they came back for me. So for 10 minutes, I laid in that ditch, conscious, by myself, just, you know, trying to, well, there's a lot of things running through your mind at that point, but you know, I was trying to get up and I couldn't. I was trying to grab my weapon to defend myself. Couldn't do that. I couldn't click the radio. The radio was busted. And at the time I was blind due to all the facial fractures. So it was, I can definitely say it was a low point in my life, playing in that ditch.
And you're there alone, all busted up. You know, you know in your mind that they've had to run the general back, and all you can hope for is somebody gets back to you in time. And fortunately, somebody did. I always, in these discussions, and we're talking to Staff Sergeant Nick Bradley, who was severely injured in 2008 in Afghanistan by an IED. Nick, I always like to give some credit to the men who come back. And can you tell us a little bit about Garrett Knight and, you know, the guy who came back?
Yeah, I love talking about Garrett. He hates it, you know, which is why I do it. I really like to push his buttons.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So Garrett, he's still active duty. He's an E8 now, which is a senior master sergeant in the Air Force. But Sergeant Knight, he was actually the vehicle in front of me. He was driving the vehicle that had the dignitary inside the vehicle. He had to take him back, and then he rapidly made it back to me as fast as he could. He drove back on a couple of flat tires even. And, you know, it sounds kind of silly, you know, at times, but, you know, when I heard his voice, I just remember an instant calm just taking over, you know, my whole body. It's just, I can breathe now because my team's here. And, you know, he jumped in the ditch with me. He started bandaging me up, called in for the medevac, you know, pop smoke. So, you know, the Black Hawk knew where to land. But he went a step further. He actually stayed with me. So I flew from there. They flew me 55 minutes away to Bagram Airfield, which is where they did my first surgery. It was a 12-hour operation. They just kind of got my body ready for transport due to all the fractures. Garrett stayed with me through that surgery. And then when I flew to Germany, Launchtal, Germany, he actually flew with me to Germany just in case I woke up, which I didn't. But he stayed by my side the whole time. There's a lot to be said about a guy that'll do that, you know?
Absolutely. And again, I think so few people serve nowadays, it's hard to understand the bond that's there and that, you know, what your buddy's going to do for you in the foxhole, if you will.
Right.
He stays with you to Germany. You end up being transported back to Walter Reed Army Medical Center. I think I saw that you had a total of something like 16 surgeries to try to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And I can only imagine that the recovery was as painful and as frustrating as anything you've ever been through in your life.
It was. You go from being able to run, you know, 5 miles every day because you're forced to, not because I chose to, but because I had to. But you go from doing that till now all of a sudden you can't sit up in a bed by yourself. You can't feed yourself. You know, you can't use the restroom by yourself. It's quite humbling, to say the least. That's an oversimplification. And then you sprinkle in all the pain and, you know, that goes along with that. It was very challenging, to say the least. You know, I remember when they brought me out of they had medically induced me into a coma. When they brought me out of the coma, they told me that they were having a hard time getting the nerves in my legs to respond. So my legs weren't working that well, and they were afraid that I might not be able to walk again. They told me I was looking at a minimum of 18 months at the hospital in Walter Reed in recovery. And, you know, to wake up to that news and then you look down and both your hands now have amputations on them and they're wrapped up. You can't really use them. You can't sit up. That's like another getting hit with another bomb, so to speak.
Well, and I think everybody goes, you know, nobody has the struggles you had, but everybody goes through some struggles in their life, maybe not of this depth and quality and weight. But what I want to transition to is, hey, I don't want anybody out there thinking that Nick Bradley doesn't have it pretty good at the moment. And I don't think you want anybody thinking that. You've gone on. You know, there's been romance. There's been kids. There's been talk about the last, you know, I guess I said, broadly speaking, 10 years, although this is a concentrated, devastating period of life, you found a way to really make something out of that, haven't you?
I did. You know, I got down a little bit while I was still in Walter Reed, and then I just, you know, I really started to put things in perspective. And 2 months later, I walked out of that hospital on my own 2 feet. So just kind of defied everything they told me. And I decided not to stop there. Went back to school, finished my degree there, started playing golf. Really, really got into golf. It's borderline unhealthy, which I like to golf. But it's funny. I got selected to play in George Bush's Wounded Warrior Golf Tournament. And, you know, by random draw, this young man was my caddy. And then, you know, we hit it off. I got to know him and his family really well. And then his daughter graduated college and we hit it off and we're about to celebrate 5 years of marriage. We have two beautiful daughters. So, you know, life has been good to me. I've had 19 surgeries to date now, so I've had to have a few extra ones. A couple years ago, I was golfing and the plate in my arm, it broke, and that was a whole ordeal. But, you know, they're still trying to keep me put together.
Well, and I wanted to back you up to sports because one of the things in reading your story and understanding you, and we have a mutual friend who says, hey, you got to talk to Nick, he's incredible. Sports has played a real role in your recovery, as I look at it. Do you have that same sense?
Agreed, 100%. You know, and I use sports, but, you know, anything that'll get you up and going, something that'll wake you up in the morning and say, hey, I get to do this today, and I'm going to do this. No matter how poorly I do it, I'm still going to get to do it. And whether I, you know, because that's the thing is I had to remind myself that I'm not 18 and young and can do everything, and, you know, sort of thing. But sports, it was so vital to my recovery.
It got you out and it got you competitive, didn't it?
It did. It did. That's exactly what it did. And which I think was needed because deep down, I'm a competitive person at everything we do. I mean, if me and my wife are playing rummy at home, I want to win. You know, it just, I want to win at everything I do. And, you know, but that it was so awesome to get to go out and, you know, play, just to play a game, just to play.
Well, you not only have a as you refer to, an unhealthy addiction to golf, you have become a player on the national team for amputee softball team. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Yeah. So back in 2015, I grew up playing baseball my whole life. Baseball was my favorite sport. I loved it so much. And, you know, I went out to do a pickup game with a church league and I was like, hey, physically, I can actually still do this. So I really got into it and I reached out to a couple buddies that I knew, other wounded vets with amputations. And they're like, hey, you need to check out this team. And I went out to tryouts and I tell you what they do is phenomenal. The U.S. Patriots, they are the Wounded Warrior Amputee Softball Team. I think they just rebranded, but they are just, what they do for wounded vets with amputations, getting them out there and recreating some of that camaraderie and that competitiveness all in one. And it was just, oh, that was just some of the most amazing times ever. I don't get to play that much anymore. My knees are starting to not like me so much.
Well, and it's interesting in a team sport, golf's sort of a singular sport, right?
Right.
When you're playing softball at this level with other guys, it's a team sport. You're in the uniform. You got that team camaraderie. Man, that sounds like a lot of what you have in the military, doesn't it?
It's exactly the way I looked at it. Every time I got to step on the field with these guys, you know, it's, you know, just going out with the same guys that just, we have the same goal in mind here and we're all going to work together to accomplish it. And, you know, even though it's, we're playing a game and we're trying to win it. It's, you know, it does. It's a lot like being downrange. Hey, we have this objective and we need to achieve it at whatever cost we have to get this done. And we're going to strap on the same uniform and lace up our boots and go get it. And it was a lot like that getting, you know, to play softball with these guys. It's, you know, it's just so good for your soul. For me anyway.
We're talking to Nick Bradley, who's a staff sergeant, retired Nick Bradley, United States Air Force, wounded in Afghanistan in 2008, and really hasn't let that result in giving up. He's married a couple of kids, involved in golf and softball. Nick, as you look back at this last decade, and as you think about, geez, I'd like to pass along some ideas to folks in the country, What lessons have you learned that you want to pass along?
Well, there's just a couple of things that I do. So for instance, when the doctors came in and, they were giving me the news that I didn't really want to hear at the time. And, that I might not walk and I'm going to be in the hospital for a long time. And, life's going to look different. That was a lot of really negative information. So I decided I'm going to spin that around and glasses half full. Right. So I just kind of came up with this saying, and that I try to tell myself every day is, if you can find the positive in every situation, you always be a positive person. And if you have that positive attitude, there's nothing you can't overcome. So I just, no matter how bad we have it, I promise someone has it worse. Someone's having a worse Monday than me right now, or anybody, and it just helps me to keep things in perspective, because perspective is just, it's key. That's one thing that I have really learned to value, is just the way I perceive things, is just looking at things in a different light.
And that's really about how you perceive it, as compared to letting somebody else put all that negativity on you.
Exactly.
Well, we really appreciate you taking some time to talk to Veterans Radio today, Staff Sergeant Nick Bradley. We are thrilled about how life is going for you, and that, there's so much positivity looking forward. And certainly as you get out there and talk to more folks, and as you get out there and play some more golf, keep doing what you're doing, because everything you're doing seems to be working.
Yes, sir, I will. And Jim, thanks for having me. It's been a blast talking to you.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month, or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.